this ridiculous and nefarious pamphlet called The Protocols of the Sages of Zion ought to elicit laughter. But it also provokes fear as much as it brings shame. For it appeals to that which is most ignominious, mean, vulgar, cynical, and ugly in the humanity of the human being. While turning its pages, one feels compelled to resist throwing it into the wastebasket and wash one's hands, as if having touched an object both impure and disgusting. How could any person, who obviously was not illiterate, someone who has learned to appreciate the value and the magic of thought and culture, amass so many vile forgeries and nasty theories, hoping to interest, if not persuade, readers of his intellectual honesty? Worse, the author of the pamphlet pretends that he speaks as a devout Christian and a defendant of Christianity. Did he really believe that good and intelligent Christian men and women would take him seriously? If ever a piece of writing could produce mass hatred, it is this one. All the archetypes of ancient and contemporary anti-Semitism are in its pages. An insult to any intelligent reader, this book is about lies and slander. Its aim was and remains to hurt, offend, and persecute, if not exterminate, an entire people, its tradition, its faith, its memory, and its right to live with a sense of dignity and hope. What kind of mind could invent so many unspeakable horrors just to increase prejudice towards an ancient people whose memory of suffering forever moved its children to beware of yielding to the seduction, to the temptation of hatred? Question. This infamous forgery is sickening. It betrays the ignorance and emptiness of its author or authors. Why then has it had such an impact? Why has it been translated in so many languages? How is one to explain its lasting commercial success? Why has it been a bestseller compared almost to the Bible and Mao Zedong's red booklet? That evil may possess a certain power of attraction that one can understand. But stupidity? One reads it, therefore, with shock and dismay. How could any fairly educated and decent man or woman lend credence to such a mishmash of crazy ideas, images, and nightmarish fairy tales? When you discover that Henry Ford I, the giant of the automobile industry, was so impressed by its content that he published it in his own paper, which had a circulation of almost 200,000 and printed 300,000 copies in book form, you no longer know what to think about automobiles. Granted, Henry Ford was not known as a friend of Jews. Hitler admired him so much that he wanted to constantly have his picture before his eyes. Still, from there to become the patron and protector of such an unworthy pamphlet was a distance that no cultured person would cross. Mind you, Ford later apologized, saying he had no idea what was being published in his own paper. The fact remains that the pamphlet was talked about in white political and pseudo-religious circles without too many people realizing that it was a fake. Its poisonous hatred may be found in Hitler's earliest and latest writings, whether in Mein Kampf or in his public utterances or in his actually last will, in his testament written, dictated in 1945. Here at home, the infamous Father Coughlin used it in his radio homilies. As for today, fanatic Muslims treat it with the reverence almost accorded to the Quran. Official visitors to Saudi Arabia would receive it as a gift from the king. If the visitor was an important figure, he would get a deluxe edition. Recently, the President Mahathir, in an official public address from Indonesia, he accused the Jewish people's ambitions to achieve absolute control of the world's media, economy, and political structures. He sounded as if he were quoting the protocols, and there was no real outcry against his shameful performance except from Jewish circles. As for the new president of Iran, how is one to explain it? That here is a man elected by his people who dares to say and to repeat, when speaking first of all to 4,000 students and then to the entire world, that he wishes that Israel be wiped off the face of the earth. In doing so, of course, he turned the 4,000 students into emissaries of hatred, into agents of those who wrote the protocol. And the fact that he had not been banned, shamed by the international community is something which leaves me perplexed. Yes, there were a few statements, but not enough. He is still president. But what were the origins of the protocols as a book? In fact, they are as nebulous as their content is delirious. First, they are not clear. Where did they come from? Basel in Switzerland, Vienna, Paris. The anti-Semitic writers themselves disagree on the way they reach the outside world. In Germany, some spread a theory that in 1897, an envoy of the Elders of Zion brought a text of 24 secret sessions of the Zionist Congress in Basel to a Masonic lodge in Frankfurt am Main. On the way, he was bribed by a Russian spy who copied all the pages and handed them over to a certain Nihilus, an anti-Semitic fanatic with some pseudo-mystical tendencies. And he is the one, therefore, who wrote or adapted the book. He himself, Nihilus himself, in his introduction to the 1911 edition of the pamphlet, has more fantasy. He writes, quote, "In 1901, a now deceased acquaintance, Court Marshal Alexei Sukhotin of Chernigov, gave into my possession a handwritten manuscript that detailed completely and clearly the secret Jewish Freemason conspiracy that will surely lead to the end of our vile world. The person who gave me this manuscript assured me that it was a faithful translation of the original documents. It has been stolen by a lady from the highest and most influential leaders of the Freemasons following a secret meeting somewhere in France, that hotbed of Masonic conspiracy. But who was the lady? That we don't know. Was she beautiful? Seductive? Did she have anything in mind, maybe to marry him or to blackmail him? We don't know. Nihilus doesn't say if he knew, but maybe he didn't. But in his 1917 edition of the pamphlet, he does add information to the story. And he says, and I quote again, "Now for the first time, I have learned from authoritative Jewish sources that the protocols as a book is nothing less than the strategic plan of world conquest, whereby the world will be brought under Israel's yoke the enemy of God. The plan worked out by the leaders of the Jewish people during the many centuries of the diaspora was finally disclosed to the elders, by the prince of the exile, Theodor Herzl, at the first Zionist Congress in Basel. But what about the lady? Well, he mentions her. He even says that he knew her name, but he had forgotten it. She made no impression on him. All he remembers is that she obtained the manuscript in mysterious ways, maybe in the bedroom. But the answer actually is offered by the Polish translator of the Nilus pamphlet. She stole it from Theodor Herzl's home. But what was she doing there? What was the lady doing in Theodor Herzl's home? A close associate of Nilus, a certain Butmi, who published the protocols as part of a violent attack on the Freemasons, says that actually they had nothing to do with Herzl and his Congress. They were written by a Jewish Freemason lodge named Mitzrayim. Secondly, no one correct answer was offered about the language in which the protocols were written and published. Nilus claims that they were written in French and translated into Russian. Theodor Fritsch, introducing his German edition, maintains that they were written in Hebrew. What is also amazing is that the first version of the pamphlet has never been found. And as Benjamin Siegel, one of the best and sharpest commentators on the pamphlet, notes tongue-in-cheek, after all, we don't deal here with a text written in antiquity or even the Middle Ages, but in the 20th century. How come that it was lost? After all, we have found so many documents of antiquity, not from the 20th century. Now, do the promoters of this pamphlet really believe in its message that we Jews are determined to attain absolute domination of the entire world? The famous French novelist and anti-Semite Céline believed it before the war. And the Hungarian war criminal László Endre believed it after the war. Céline writes about it in his horrible book called Bagatelle pour un massacre. This great novelist wrote one of the most obnoxious, ugly, violent, vile books. Anti-Semitic. The punishment was, it was very bad literature. His novel, A Journey to the End of Night, was great literature. The only one which was really great. But this one and the others were better into the wastebasket. But László Endre wrote in his last letter before being executed, quote, "The protocols of the elders of Zion are true. The means to establish a world kingdom are now in Jewish hands, and they will destroy everything that might constitute an obstacle to the new world state. Jewish policy is to exterminate not only those who did something, but even those who might yet do something or could have done." These words of a war criminal, criminal against humanity, were written while the world had just awakened from its fiery nightmare of Auschwitz and Treblinka, where Jews, we know, perished simply because they were Jewish. Now, we must remember that such idiotic and wild theories of Jewish conspiracy are not new and weren't even new then when the first pamphlet appeared on the stage. Already in antiquity, slanderous rumors were spread in many quarters about the Jewish people's stubbornness to go on existing in a world whose life and style were so different from others. The motives were political, sociological, economical, military, and religious. In Rome, Julianus was angry at the Jews for in their endless loyalty to one God, they do nothing, I quote him, they do nothing to appease other gods, which they believe are meant for us alone. Their barbaric pride brought them to this folly. Cicero, who wrote so beautifully about friendship, he distrusted the Jews as witnesses. He said, quote, they steal our gold in Italy and send it to Jerusalem. Tacitus called Jews abominable, and in Seneca's eyes they were simply criminals. Both Lysimachus of Alexandria and Posidonius of Apamea repeated a fable by a priest named Manetton of the 3rd century before the Common Era, that the Jews were not liberated from Egypt, but expelled by the Pharaohs, not because they wanted to be free and because they believed in the God of Abraham, but because they were spreading disease. And here is their vision of Exodus. Quote, the king, the Pharaoh, gathered all the invalids, numbering 80,000, and locked them in special places together with local convicts. And they fled to the land of Canaan. An Egyptian priest from Heliopolis, named after the god Osiris, changed his nationality and took on a new name, Moses. The concept of Sabbath, which after all remains to us as one of the great achievements then, socially considered to be a blessing for those laborers who worked hard all week. No, these Jew haters then already explained it as follows. While wandering in the desert, they developed a strange disease called Sabbatosis, which forced them to rest on the seventh day. Wild stories circulating about Jews accused them of annually kidnapping a Greek pagan. They fed him well before sacrificing him. At the same time, they were accused of keeping a donkey's head inside the temple and worship it. Jewish customs, practicing circumcision, abiding by family laws, and celebrating solidarity were criticized, condemned, and ridiculed. Following the revolt of the Maccabeans, with the establishment of the Hasmonean kingdom, Hellenic patriots turned their rage against Jews, and there the reasons were political and military. Strange as it may sound, many of these crazy stories survived the centuries and found their place in sources that preceded and followed the protocols of the elders of Zion. And maybe we should have a look at the pamphlet itself. I read it and reread it and with disbelief. It was subjected to a variety of influences, including a book by a mediocre French writer, some believed he was of Jewish origin, named Maurice Joly, who years later committed suicide. And we shall perhaps return to him and to his book in a moment. In the 1840s, a certain Millinger, alias Osman Bey, he wrote a book called World Conquest by Jews, describing all the woes Jews bring unto Christians, the example which has been even now used by those who hate Israel, about the need and use of Christian blood for baking Passover matzah. A film on Egyptian television, on Lebanese television, had actually this in it, showing the beginning, showing a group of rabbis and Jewish important people deciding which Christian should be killed in order to use his blood for matzah. Another influence on the protocols came from a German, Hermann Goetze, alias Sir John Ratcliffe. At the end of the 19th century, he published a novel called Biarritz. The novel begins like a thriller, filled with suspense and fear. A strange rabbi gives the password to a watchman and enters the cemetery of Prague to recite a prayer. An older convert from Judaism speaks to a young scientist about Kabbalah. And, says the book, every 100 years, during the holiday of Sukkot, which we celebrated last week, emissaries of the 12 biblical tribes of Israel gather at midnight at that cemetery and discuss how to conquer the world. The last meeting took place in 7060, when the movement of Judaism, maybe they meant Hasidism, started. Now we are 17,807 years since the destruction of Jerusalem, designated as the year by the Kabbalistic Sanhedrin, says the book, and there's the scene ends, it ends and ends in infamy. And so, you read this, you read it, and you don't believe it, because the scene ends with Satan's appearance in the form of a golden calf to be adored by the assembly. Now, years later, the Jews, which was a Russian pamphlet, like the protocols and preceding the protocols, presented most part of this scene not as fiction, but as facts. I shall read to you just a small passage of that, just to show you what it says and the way it says it. It reads, supposed to be literature. The tower clock of the town hall struck 11. At the first stroke, a key clicked in the lock of the cemetery gates. Then followed profound silence, which indicated that the cemetery was open. The lights in the Jewish houses were gradually dying out, and at the same time, the sounds of the merry feasting also subsided. Mysterious silence reigned in that terrible place. The gates cracked slowly and softly. The rustling of long coats was heard touching the stones and shrubbery. Finally, a vague white figure appeared and slipped by like a shadow along the pathways. This figure knelt before one of the tombstones. 3 times he touched the stone with its forehead and softly whispered a prayer. Along the path leading from the gates came an old man, bent, limping, sighing and coughing. He came over to the ancient tombstone and lowered himself on his knees near the white figure that had entered before him, and he too whispered a prayer. Then heavy footsteps were heard, and a tall, impressive figure appeared on the road, clad in a white mantle, and he too fell down on his knees, as though unwillingly, in front of the tombstone. 13 times this was repeated. The 13 old men came over to the tombstone. And who were they? It seemed that the prayer shawls had fallen off the heads of praying old men, and a row of dead skulls appeared. At that moment, the clock struck 12. A sharp metallic sound rang out on the grave, after which a blue flame appeared and illumined the 13 kneeling figures. I greet you, Roshei Ben Abbot of the 12 tribes of Israel, announced a dull voice. We greet you, son of the accursed, said the others. 100 years have already passed. Where have the Nisiyim come from, the princes of the tribes come from? From the lands where the nation of Adonai had been scattered by the orders of our forefathers, say they. Are you ready to fulfill the promise during the coming century? We are ready. Then say, whose representatives are you, and where do you come from? Tribe of Judah. From Amsterdam, replied a strong, loud voice. Tribe of Benjamin, Toledo came the dull answer. Tribe of Levi, Worms. Tribe of Manasseh, Budapest. Tribe of Gad, Krakow. It went on and on. And then says the last one, and I am the representative of the unfortunate and exiles, said the man who asked the questions in a dull voice. I am myself wandering about all over the world in order that I may unite you for the sake of the cause of redemption, which has been promised to the seed of Abraham, and which was taken from them by the sons of him who was crucified. Who is here of the house of Aaron? Let him rise, scrutinize the heads of tribes, and gather the council. And this is the whole thing is going on. At the end, there is a rabbi giving a speech. And the rabbi says, it's in the protocols. Our fathers have bequeathed to the elect of Israel the duty of gathering together once each century around the tomb of the Grand Master Caleb, the holy rabbi Shimeon ben Yehuda, whose knowledge gives the elect of each generation power over all the earth and authority over all the descendants of Israel. For 18 centuries, Israel has been at war with that power which was first promised to Abraham, but which was taken from him by the cross, trampled underfoot, humiliated by its enemies, living ceaselessly under the threat of death, of persecutions, of rape, and every kind of violation. The people of Israel has not succumbed. And if it is dispersed over the whole earth, that is because it is to inherit the whole earth. For 18 centuries, our wise men have been fighting the cross courageously, and gradually our people is rising up, and its power increases day by day. Ours is that God of today whom Aaron raised up for us in the desert. The day when we shall have made ourselves the sole possessors of all the gold in the world, the real power will be in our hands. And it goes on and on. And they believed in it. They believed that that is not fiction, cheap fantasy. They believed it was true. They really believed that the goal of the Jews was simply to dominate the world. I myself had once a discussion on French television with a very good Catholic. And I was afraid then, because it was before 67, and we thought that Israel at that time, 3 weeks before the Six-Day War, and you were too young, all of you, to remember that, there was fear in the Jewish community, in the world. We were afraid that Israel might lose the war. And he said to me so innocently, he said, why are you so worried? After all, the Jews are in Washington, the Jews are in London, they have such power. And I said, hey, you tell me, do you really believe we have that much power? He said, of course, come on, otherwise, how did you survive? And tell me, do you really believe that we control Washington? He said, well, we control the White House. Of course, he said, London, Paris. I said, tell me, you think we control the world? You know what? It's not, you know it's not true. For the last 20 centuries, Christianity and Islam dominate the world. I am ready to take it over for one generation. I promise you, when we will give it back to you, it will not be worse. But they believe in it. Back to Maurice Joly. In 1864, he published a satire against Napoleon III. It was called Dialogues in Hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. It doesn't deal with Jews, but with Freemasons, who implement Machiavelli's method to destroy Montesquieu's vision of social justice. Clearly, the villain is the emperor. Some years later, a certain Rakhkovsky, a member of the Tsar's secret police, the Okhrana, felt it politically useful to transform Joly's fictional story into protocols between elders of Zion, plotting to take over the rule over world affairs. The translation was done by Matthew Golovinsky, who lived in France, helped and exploited by Sergei Nilus, of whom we spoke already. And the pamphlet, as exists today, is still, as we said, popular. Its content is known. We guess what it says. All the malevolent fantasies, the crazy accusations of Jews hating the world, wishing to dominate the whole world, are silly, but they are still in that pamphlet. If one is to believe the authors, we have only one interest, we Jews, And that is to humble all non-Jews, shame all non-Jews, abolish their laws, violate their beliefs, and whatever is saintly and sanctified to them, and use all the means possible, available to us, to achieve our reign over the entire planet. That's why they believe. And all that is communicated in 24 chapters, presented as lectures and speeches, given by and to a secret Jewish government at secret meetings of the Zionist Congress. As we said, the pamphlet went through several editions. A few chapters were pre-published in 1903 in the newspapers Namia, or The Flag, under the title The Great and the Small, Antichrist Considered an Imminent Possibility. The official censorship bureau in Moscow approved its publication as a book in 1905, and the metropolitan of the city was so impressed with its tone and message that he ordered it to be read in 368 churches. A second edition followed in 1907 with few changes, but in his new preface, actually, this Nihilus said, "There is no room left for doubt. With all the might and terror of Satan, the reign of the triumphant King of Israel is approaching our unregenerate world. The King born of the blood of Zion, the Antichrist, is near to the throne of the world." 10 years later, a larger edition was published under a new title, At the Door, Here Comes the Antichrist and the Reign of the Devil on Earth. Could go on and cite for you all and more titles again, that we are condemned because we want to acquire so much gold, so much property, so much influence, that at one point the world would simply fall into our hands. That's all we want. Now, strangely enough, the pamphlet was taken seriously in various countries and in various quarters. Listen to what the London Times, one of the most honorable newspapers in the world, what it had to say in its issue of May 8, 1920. I quote, "What are these protocols? Are they authentic? Are they a forgery? If so, whence comes the uncanny note of prophecy? Prophecy in part fulfilled, in parts far gone in the way of fulfillment. Have we been struggling these tragic years to blow up and extirpate the secret organization of German world dominion, only to find beneath it another, more dangerous body because more secret? If so, what malevolent assembly concocted these plans and gloated over their exposition? Have we, by straining every fiber of our national body, escaped the Pax Germanica, only to fall into a Pax Judaica? The elders of Zion, as represented in their protocols, are by no means kinder taskmasters than William II and his henchmen would have been." And that is not a pamphlet simply published by Jew haters or even by Henry Ford, but by the Times of London. Other papers reacted more or less in the same way. The Spectator in England and the Morning Post treated the pamphlet as a genuine document. But 15 months after its first editorial, and here we must recognize the truth, the same Times of London had the decency and courage to print a public apology and an extraordinary series of 3 articles unmasking the pamphlet as an outrageous forgery. And it opens it by saying, in articles from our Constantinople correspondent published yesterday and on Tuesday, we proved that the so-called protocols of the elders of Zion, which have been believed by some since their publication in 1905 to indicate a Jewish plot against civilization, were a clumsy forgery. Today, our correspondent, the same correspondent, reviews the use to which the protocols were put in recent Russian politics and summarizes his conclusion. And he goes on proving the stupid forgery, the clumsy forgery. And so, what do we say? We say that we know very well that there is something which appeals to so many people. It's the theory of conspiracy. People, naive people, love the scapegoat, love to have someone to blame for all our failures, all our shortcomings, all our mistakes, all our misfortunes. And then they come to the conspiracy. And to say, of course, that the Jewish people survive because of the conspiracy that we are engaging in. It's so easy. And this is what they have done. And we read it, and we are simply puzzled by the fact that to this day, some of the arguments are still circulating. Now, we have seen in the Middle Ages, of course, the Black Plague was a Jewish conspiracy. The Black Plague occurred, said our enemies, because Jews have shamed sacred Christian symbols. The poverty in the world, it exists because Jews steal from the poor. Hunger, because Jewish food merchants want to make more money on their product. Conspiracy theories accompany general events as well. Haven't they been invoked to explain the assassination of John Kennedy? Strangely enough, this is the only conspiracy, perhaps, where Jews have not been involved. They don't say that we Jews killed Kennedy. Nor do they say that Marilyn Monroe was killed, she didn't commit suicide, and again, they don't say that the lover of Marilyn Monroe was a Jew. Well, thank God for some miracles. At the same time, hasn't Muslim propaganda spread insane rumors that the immense 9/11 tragedy was the work of the Mossad? This happened now, already in the 21st century. Hitler wasn't the only one to draw inspiration from the protocols of and their myth of Jewish conspiracy. Together with his chief propagandist, Joseph Goebbels, he succeeded in poisoning the mind of millions of his subjects and admirers. When he spoke with growing hatred of international Jewry, he made Jews responsible for the First World War, Germany's military defeat, its national humiliation at Versailles, the debacle of its currency. All that was a fault of Jews. But the same could be said, and has been said, of Stalin, especially in his later years, when stricken with paranoia, he saw bloodthirsty plotters everywhere, hence the infamous show trials and the execution of his old companions and the murder of Jewish writers and artists. He too was obsessed with Jewish conspiracy. Was he poorly informed or literally mad, pathologically mad, that he maintained that the AJDC, a superb Jewish charity organization, was actually a cover for CIA activities? Conspiracy is the key word for the anti-Semite. In the eyes of the Jew hater, it explains all that is happening in the world to this day. I saw material in Poland, which is spread in the provinces, saying that actually, believe it or not, Lech Walesa, who's not my favorite colleague, that Walesa was a Jew. They even gave the name, a Jewish name. They go on saying that all the Polish leaders today are Jews. They say even, believe it or not, Cardinal Glemp is a Jew. He is the worst anti-Semite that Poland has today. I think they say it maybe to make him feel ashamed, as a Jew. So, what should one do, really, when they believe that the richest men in the world are Jews, the poorest men in the world are Jews, the most talented are Jews, the most dangerous are Jews? They said already in the protocol that the French Revolution was a Jewish endeavor. Everything was Jews. One would really think that the Jew has acquired the gift of ubiquity. Omniscience and omnipotence is theirs. Once more, as many times before, one cannot but wonder at the ignorance of these Jew haters. Do they really believe what they say? Do they really believe what they believe in? Now, how are we to respond to these fanatics? Why is it so appealing to so many what they say about us? Of all the isms produced by the last centuries, we know communism failed, Nazism failed, thank God, fascism failed, anti-Semitism is still alive. Of all the diseases of all these centuries, only anti-Semitism as a virus is still here, doing its damage, causing hurt, spreading hatred and death. Fanaticism is here, and what do we do then? Now, I believe, of course, what hurts so much in all that is that it deals with language. The protocols were written with words. Words that otherwise could be used for the welfare of humanity, for the happiness of children. But they were used and misused to spread hatred. Like love or fate or wealth, hatred possesses its own language. Being each other's instrument, they stimulate and feed one another to the point of being unable to act or even breathe alone. In fact, hatred and fanaticism need one another to live and find fulfillment. Even when hidden, suppressed, or mute, hatred finds ways to express itself. The easiest way to discern its presence, study its language. Hatred, violent and vulgar, is never eternally mute. It cannot forever manage to restrain itself from letting its offensive and aggressive impulses weigh on reality by distorting its human aspect. Whoever hates becomes a carrier of hate, which ends up by modulating, shaping, and invading his or her thoughts and words. Whatever they may say will hear the mask and bear the mark of hatred and thus of death, the ultimate consequence of hatred. Can one speak of inspired hatred? Can hatred ever be at the origin of great inspired and creative projects in the fields of literature, philosophy, or the arts? Hatred and inspiration seem to be incompatible, irreconcilable. Hatred kills inspiration for the simple reason that hatred kills everything else. Occasionally a poet may shout and howl hatred, but he or she cannot turn it into song. A song of hatred is not a song, it is hatred. I would go further and declare that a poet of hatred will quickly cease to be a poet. Art and hatred do not go together. The first is out to create and exalt creation. The other wishes to bring it down and work towards its destruction and humiliation and downfall. Whereas one creates for someone, one uses hatred against someone. Art is conceived as a promise for the creator, whereas hatred represents a threat to the hater as well as to his victims. In the final analysis, hatred signifies the end rather than the beginning of any literary or artistic endeavor, as well as their futility. I know this thesis is far from being totally foolproof. Unpleasant examples to the contrary do exist. Ezra Pound in America and Céline in France. Knut Hamsun, the great Knut Hamsun, author of Hunger in Norway, and Wagner in Germany, confirm the general rule. Well, we know one finds anti-Semitic utterances in Voltaire and Kant, T.S. Eliot and André Gide, and even Fyodor Dostoevsky and Mussorgsky. Voltaire hated the Bible, which he called a mishmash of Babylonian, Egyptian, sodomy stories. He, Voltaire, wanted the Jews and their culture to be humiliated and punished, but with strange magnanimity he remarked that whatever will be done to them, they ought not to be burned. Luther said they ought to be burned. Still, some of these writers and so many others in many cultures were not anti-Semites. Without trying to excuse them, one must admit that their unfortunate remarks were a product of ancestral prejudice and religious bigotry. Yes, some of them rooted in Christianity, yes. So, what do we say, therefore? We say that talent and literary language can flourish in freedom alone, and hate and freedom do not go together. In totalitarian environment, the literary production is rather poor, except for that of the dissidents, the victims. Sholokhov and Zhdanov are lightweights compared to Isaac Babel, Osip Mandelstam, Vasily Grossman, and Boris Pasternak. As for Hitler's Germany, it couldn't boast of one single great literary work. Simply put, in a universe of hatred, only an outcry against hatred is capable of coming close to art, to truth, to humanity. I may be naive to suggest or to wish that a Nazi Thomas Mann or Franz Werfel seemed to me inconceivable, but I do believe it. As a matter of fact, the overwhelming majority of great writers, poets, movie makers, novelists and thinkers, with the exception of Martin Heidegger, left the Third Reich and went into exile. As for the Soviet Union, Alexander Solzhenitsyn became a great moral voice only when he rose against the communist ideology of the Gulag. Centuries earlier, Romeo and Juliet would not have become the masterwork we all admire had Shakespeare made it into a play of hatred between clans, families, tribes, instead of a love story, an unhappy love story of two youngsters purely taken by love, dominated by love, attracted to love, desperately in love, or loving desperately. So naturally a question arises, how does one recognize the language of hatred? What words does it set forth, like scouts, emissaries, or agents to occupy a position? Some are open and vulgar, others prefer to sound nuanced and coded. What they have in common, reductionists, they bring down literature to still popular, if not glorified, certain communities, in certain communal groups. How could their followers be brought back to moral sanity? How could their killers and suicide warriors be disarmed? What should we do today with the threat of carriers of hate who believe that what they are doing to innocent victims, not only in Israel, which was the first to be subjected to these atrocities, but now almost everywhere on every continent, even in Muslim countries, I refer to the suicide killers. Those who believe and are taken by their people as martyrs. They are not martyrs, they are killers. Both Christians and Jews know a martyr is not somebody who kills for his faith, but who dies for his faith. So, how can we therefore believe in humanity unless if we defend it against those who hate it? Well, my good friends, at the risk of disappointing some naive students, and those students here in our great school are not naive. They are maybe innocent, but not naive. Jewish history knows no memory of political, economic, or social religious conspiracy. Whatever Moses has done, he has done in the open. Joshua did not conspire to succeed him as leader of Israel. David did not conspire with his friend Jonathan to unseat his father Saul from his throne. Hillel and Shammai, Rabbi Akiba, Rabbi Ishmael, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, or Resh Lakish, Rav and Shmuel, and their numerous disciples were involved in study, not in conspiracy. The only holy conspiracy mentioned in our religious chronicles can be found only in Hasidic folklore. We are told of three great masters, the seer of Lublin, the Maggid of Koznitz, Rabbi Mendel of Rimenov. They decided at the beginning of the 19th century, already fraught with violence and bloodshed, to precipitate redemption. They felt it was enough. And they decided that they have to bring the Messiah. Convinced that their joint efforts would produce the needed result for their people in exile and for all peoples in the world, their hopes were high, but premature. All three left. They left this world the same year. Could the idea of messianism, the Jewish soft offering to humanity, be considered a conspiracy? Yes, it could. But remember, its aim was never to conquer the world, but to redeem it. We have said it before, here, from this very place. And it bears repeating. We believe that even when the Messiah will arrive, it does not mean that the whole world will become Jewish. It means that it will become more hospitable, more compassionate, more understanding. In other words, more human. Open to hope, open to solidarity, open to what is noble in all of us. Thank you.
You've been listening to the second of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. We began with an introduction by Professor Stephen Katz, director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odecht and Tim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thank you for joining us.